Motor City Rear.
If you can sweat through a shirt, even in winter, like I did, it could be a medical condition called hyperhidrosis. But there's something that can help control severe underarm sweating for up to 6 months with just one treatment. It's called Botox. Yep, Botox, botulinum toxin type A injection therapy, helps control severe underarm sweating when antiperspirants don't work. It's approved by the FDA and covered by many insurance plans. For an experienced dermatologist in your area, go to Botox.com or call 1-800-BOTOX-MD.
You should not be treated if you have an infection at the injection site. Serious allergic reactions and cardiac events have been rarely reported. If you think you're having unusual symptoms such as difficulty swallowing, speaking, or breathing, call your doctor immediately. The most common side effects include injection site pain and bleeding and non-underarm sweating. Ask your dermatologist if prescription Botox therapy is right for you. See our ad in All You magazine at Walmart.
Go to Botox.com or call 1-800-BOTOX-MD today. Help get severe underarm sweating under control with Botox.
It's the Memorial Day Overstocked event at your Chrysler and Jeep Superstores. We're loaded with inventory that we have to move, with factory-to-consumer incentives on nearly every Chrysler and Jeep vehicle in stock, which means your dealer can pass along these great savings to you. Choose the award-winning Chrysler 300, versatile town and country with exclusive stow-and-go seating and storage, the Jeep Liberty Sport 4x4, and the 5-star crash test-rated Jeep Grand Cherokee. Or qualified returning Daimler Chrysler employee lessees can lease a Jeep Commander 4x4 for just $199 a month for 27 months with $2,549 due at signing and pay no security deposit. Tax title and license extra. Now you can get the Chrysler or Jeep vehicle you've been looking for. Hurry to your Chrysler and Jeep superstores by May 31st before the Memorial Day Overstocked event ends. Call 1-888-925-JEEP for lease details. Offer requires dealer participation and a lease through Chrysler Financial. Must take delivery from dealer stock by 7506. Residency restrictions apply. Excludes SRT vehicles, 2007 models, and Crossfire. Jeep is a registered trademark of Daimler Chrysler.
May 26th, race fans will warm up with a celebration at Miller Lite Card Day. And on May 28th, thousands of fans will have tickets for a performance like no other. It ain't opera. It's the 90th running of the greatest spectacle in racing, the Indy 500. General admission is only $20. Reserve seats start at just $40. You can get tickets. Call 800-822-INDY. That's 800-822-INDY. Or log on at IndianapolisMotorSpeedway.com. That's www.IndianapolisMotorSpeedway.com. The 90th running of the Indianapolis 500. Consider this your invitation to get tickets for the largest single-day sports performance on earth. That's entertainment. Celebrate the spectacle.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Sunday night in the Motor City. We're happy in this town. I know this goes all over the world via the internet. People listening in Europe and Mexico and, man, Korea, China. Lots of places all over the world via the internet. WRIF.com and RadioPower.org. But right here in Detroit, we're happy. The Detroit Pistons, that's a basketball team. I got to tell the people maybe that are living 5,000 or 6,000 miles away. And it was the semifinals, and the Pistons, Detroit Pistons, beat the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Cavs, as they're called, 79-61 in the seventh game. Wasn't even a contest. Detroit moves on to face Miami in the finals of the conference. Fourth year in a row that the Pistons have made it into the conference finals. Actually, nobody's done that since the Chicago Bulls did it almost 15, 16 years ago. So much to talk about, right? As usual, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. We'll only talk about immigration, right? Because there isn't anything else. Everything else has disappeared from the table. So it'll only be immigration. We won't talk about the war. We won't talk about gas prices. We won't talk about the illegal wiretapping and our erosion of constitutional liberties. We won't talk about the taxes that the Bush Co. has given away to the rich. Nope. It's only immigration. But I got just a couple other little personal things to talk about. You may want to comment on, well, only immigration. Or actually, you could comment on some of the things that that we're not supposed to talk about anymore because we've moved way beyond that. Yeah, the war, for instance, just kind of goes on. Americans get killed every day. Actually, Americans do not get killed every day, but American soldiers do get killed pretty frequently, heading up towards 2,500, a war based on a lie, absolutely unnecessary for our security. It's made us less secure. Well, hey, you don't even have to call in, do you? Because there it all is. What we just want to know is, when is it going to end? And as usual with the gas prices, they spike out at over $3 a gallon in some places. They never got here, I don't think. Actually, maybe a few places, but average in the Detroit area never got beyond $2.99.9. So we never hit $3. But now, hey, I just got it for $2.68. So, hey, I don't even care anymore. But I told you, I filled up. Give you an idea of the size car I'm driving. $45 to fill it up. But as I think I've said a number of times, people have been asking me about this, so I'll say it again. At least, I mean, I'd rather most of that money stay in my pocket. But the idea that I am exclusively filling up at Citgo Gas, Citgo, which is owned by the Venezuelan government, and the profits, all the profits, and that means what's left over after reinvestment in the enterprise and salaries are paid and all of that, that what's left over, rather than going to these stockholders from these privately held companies that have just been ripping us so badly, taking us to the cleaners and then using it to reward themselves. In fact, they're using it to reward themselves, and then the Bush, at least the American stockholders, get even more money because he just gave them a tax break. What a racket. What an absolute racket. Hey, by the way, if you're new to the broadcast, and it's been increasingly so that I keep getting email or even phone calls at 313-298-WRIF or from people who say they've heard this show for the first time. So as you can tell right from out of the gate, I'm opinionated, and you can be as well. There's sometimes you'll hear initials. One of them is BCF. That's the Bush crime family. People will use that. So if someone says BCF, rather than that whole mouthful of the Bush crime family, you'll hear that. Or some people will greet me or say goodbye with ITMFA. ITMFA. Well, I'm not going to say what that stands for on the air because I'd lose my job. But you can go to ITMFA.com, or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, P-E-T-E-R. W-E-R-B-E.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. Actually, I'd prefer you did that because you can link to ITMFA and you can see all the other stuff I have there. Nothing for sale. Nothing for sale at all. If you want to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Takes care of all the business, doesn't it? Yeah, I guess so. Well, here, I guess the other thing that all the talk shows are talking about, I don't always like to do that, but it's okay, is my wife and I went to the opening of The Da Vinci Code, right? That controversial movie that all the critics say suck, right? They say it's boring, the music is overbearing, the dialogue is not very good, Tom Hanks' hair is weird. Really, someone said that. I think it was A.O. Scott in the New York Times. Well, I'd read the book. Well, let me put it this way. I liked the movie. It didn't knock me right off my feet because I knew the story. I'd read the book. So I knew that, well, I don't want to tell you anything. You might not know if you haven't done either. But so the suspense was all gone. There was no suspense. I mean, I knew who the bad guy was, although it's kind of easy to figure out. And I knew all the premises of it. And so it, but still, and it was long, 2 hours and 40 minutes, but hey, with prices these days, I don't mind long movies, you get your money's worth. So, a lot of these right-wingers, a lot of these devout Christians were offended by it, were making a lot of, one, that it wasn't well-received by the critics, but someone said, or a number of people have said, that it's critic-proof. When you've already had 40 million people buy the book, 40 million people have bought The Da Vinci Code in either hardcover or paperback or trade edition, right? And then they've got all these other things, decoding the Da Vinci Code, and there's been just jillions of spinoffs. It's interesting to whether you find it offensive or whether you like it or whether whatever you think about it. Why it has hit such a chord? And that would be an interesting thing for those of you who are religious and find the movie offensive. And hey, I can understand why you would find it offensive. My wife and I went to, what's it called, the Birmingham Palladium. And they had like, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 showings of it, maybe more. And outside, what a carnival. They had all these pickets there denouncing the film. And this, I didn't even stop to find out who they were. They had these professionally produced banners, long banners. It takes like 2 or 3 people to hold. And then everybody had an individually printed sign. You know, sometimes when you go to anti-war demonstrations or if you see them on television, you can tell they're hand-done. I mean, 99% of them are hand-done. These were all professionally printed. And I walked by one woman who had a sign, and she said, this is heresy and blasphemy. That's what her sign said anyway, so she was saying it twice. So I said, yeah, because what's heresy? Heresy is denying official doctrine. Well, I don't think it's any, what is it? Any secret, or I'm not giving away the movie if I tell you that the Da Vinci Code really strikes at the heart in many ways of the Christian story. Christ being the savior of, as he used to call it, mankind. And blasphemy, that it insults the religion or its principal figures. And in the sense that it's saying that it's the greatest story ever sold, which is a line from the book, playing on the greatest story ever told. That's what I think there was a movie or something like that from the 50s. They say it's the greatest story ever sold, that that it is on the face of it blasphemous. And but it gets the word scary, right? Remember, when's the last time we heard blasphemy? It wasn't real good. Remember the guy, the Christian in Afghanistan, that was accused of blasphemy, and they were going to like execute him. And then all the riots and deaths and property destruction around the blasphemous, is that the right word? Yeah, blasphemous portrayal of Muhammad in those cartoons. So people take insults to their religion pretty drastically. In fact, some of the bishops of the Catholic Church were making, I thought, almost these ominous remarks, saying that with other religions, people react not so peacefully and stuff. I'm saying, whoa, what are they doing? Are they trying to, you know, encourage Catholics to riot? In fact, I asked one of the security people, I said, anybody acting out in any of these? And she said, no, thankfully not. Well, that's to our credit. And I not being a believer, it's a little hard for me to understand in any direct, empathetic way, to really understand. I hear things that are dismissive or insultive or whatever of things that I believe in, and I don't like that, but it never occurs to me to go wild about it the way some of the people have. Would I recommend it? I don't know. I don't like recommending things to people. Did I like it? Yeah, I liked it. Even though I knew everything about it, there wasn't a single change from the book. I mean, a few things. But I'll tell you one thing. It's a very complex story in the book, and a couple of times my wife whispered to me, "What is the do 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 do?" And I said, "Oh, that's the da 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 da." And she went, "Oh, okay." And she said after, you know, if you hadn't have been giving me the info on this, I'm not sure I would have exactly followed who was who and why they were doing that. Well, you know who's the bad guy and who's the good guy. I mean, that works. Let's see. The Zogby poll found that Catholics, a plurality, 42%, said that after hearing about the book and the movie, they intend to seek truth by studying the Bible more closely. Okay, so maybe this works for the Catholics rather than harming them, maybe rather than defaming them, rather than the plot's contention that, in fact, there was a conspiracy at the upper levels of the Catholic Church to suppress some information that is key both to their religion and to the plot of the movie. So, and one thing that occurred to me, of course, these folks can dish it out. They just loved it when the Passion of the Christ appeared, and that got a big, huge viewership. But, man, they can't take it, can they? Survey shows that two-thirds of Catholics who were familiar with the Da Vinci Code storyline did not believe that the leaders of the Catholic Church understand the truth as portrayed in the film, but are suppressing it. Well, it's fiction. Hello. Just 12%. Let's see here. Said they believe the book. They believe the book over their church leaders. More than one in five, 21%, said they are unsure about the claim in the book. So that means that's a third when you add that up. A third of the people either believe the book or they were unsure about the claims in the book. Well, a lot of the claims in the book and in the movie are historically accurate. And the church does not always have the most pleasant history when you think about the witch hunts and the Inquisition and stuff like that, the wars, all of that stuff. Women were less certain of their church leaders than men. While 78% of the men said they do not believe church leaders are suppressing the truth as portrayed in the film, just 58% of women agreed. One in four women said that they were unsure about the suppression of information. Well, I don't know. That's their problem. That's their business, I guess. But it's all told, this last weekend, the Da Vinci Code hauled in worldwide $250 million, second highest in history. Only Star Wars, Attack of the Clones, did better than that. Here, for the first weekend, it pulled in $77 million domestically. And I think that was number 13. But Paul Garabedian, president of Box Office Tracker Exhibitor Relations, said that you had a built-in audience from the book and the awareness levels were so high from this film. You would have to live under a rock not to know this movie was opening. Well, okay, I don't see the phones lighting up over that one, so I don't know what to say other than what I just said. 313-298-WRIF, if you have any comments? I mean, one of the things, both from those of you who are hurt, insulted, or whatever one is, by the heresy and blasphemy of this film, so what? I mean, for one thing, if you don't accept Jesus as your Savior, I mean, don't you get punished anyways? I mean, it would seem to me if there was a charitable God, he would forgive us ignorant sinners and people that don't get it. You only have your intellect, right? So if something doesn't seem real to you, well, then it doesn't. So what are you going to do? All right, so we'll talk about the only subject, the absolute only subject that submerges all others, the war and gas prices and wiretapping and tax giveaways to the rich and what's happening to the economy for the middle class and the working class, and we'll talk about immigration. Well, part of it is Bush. Here's a Yahoo News, Associated Press. Bush wants newcomers to learn English. So what's the obvious line? That's the straight line. Bush wants newcomers to learn English. All right. It's so obvious what I would say, I'm not even going to say it. Right? But he said that the White House took both sides in a dispute over English being the national language. Let's see. What the president has said all along, that he wants to make sure that people who become American citizens have a command of the English language. Don't they? Aren't they, like, kind of almost have to? Isn't all this stuff in English? Not bilingual, the citizenship papers and all that, is it? But there's just something creepy about that. Gonzalez, where is he? Oh, yeah. Oh, it's the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The president has never supported making English the national language. I don't see the need to have legislation or law that says English is going to be the national language. What the hell does that mean anyways? So you put it in there. I mean, if you want to get along in this society, and every immigrant knows this, you have to have a command of English. And all immigrants, are you listening, those of you of German ancestry, Italian ancestry, Russian, Bulgarian, I don't know. Do I have to name them all? When our forebears came from Europe, they didn't speak English. They had these rough European ways, particularly if they go back, like mine do, into the 19th century. And they were pretty much despised by the people that were already been here and been here for a couple of generations, and particularly the ones that had come from where English had already been spoken, the British Isles. And they say, who are these foreigners that won't learn our language and eat funny food and their whole districts stink of this odd you know, meals that they cook, and on and on and on, and their rough ways, and are an insult to America, and they, I mean, you know what it says on the bottom of, I mean, I meant to bring that in. That's kind of been repealed, along with like the Fourth Amendment and stuff like that. You know, give me your tired, hungry masses, and no more. And so please, no more. We don't want any more of your hungry, tired masses. Anyway, this current crop of immigrants, including the Hispanic ones, are learning English faster than our grandfathers and great-grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers do. And the ones that, particularly ones that are anxious to stay here. A lot of things. Let me see if there's so much stuff in here. I mean, I'm getting the most hysterical emails. This one guy who ought to know better, he's telling me that there's going to be 500 million people in this country because 200 million more people are going to come. Well, let me tell you this. Let me tell you, I don't have a lot of solutions other than kind of grand ones for this problem with immigration. And immigration always is a problem, always has been. It was the biggest problem for the Native American people here who lost their whole country and lost about 30 million dead throughout the whole hemisphere. That was a real problem. Immigration was a real problem for them. Destroyed their cultures, destroyed their society, and totally looted it of all of its gold, sent it back to Spain and wherever to bail out these European economies that were collapsing in the 15th and 16th century, and made slaves of lots of them. The ones that couldn't be enslaved because didn't work real well, they just died, and so then they brought in African slaves, you know, all that stuff. So 40% of here, I've just got all these notes written down. Talk about this big border. Okay, we're going to get this big border there. Well, it turns out that 40% of the illegals are people that have overstayed their visas. So that doesn't even deal with people coming across the borders. And here's how I conceive of immigrants. They are our fellow workers. Now, that's a phrase right out of American history, fellow workers. It was used in its heyday, and it's still used today by the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, as they're called. You can go to IWW.org. Now, throughout the history of this hemisphere, and in Europe as well, there's been privileged sectors and disadvantaged sectors. And we live, it's odd, isn't it, on one, on our northern border, actually, never mind. Won't start this. Canada's to the south of us in Detroit, isn't it? But go look at a map. Our northern neighbors, they're privileged like we are. Then you go down to the south, though, in Mexico and below, they're disadvantaged. So our fellow workers, because they're industrious, because they want to help and support their families, they go where the good jobs are. So you can say, well, what the hell? I mean, sure, I understand that, but I don't want my good job to suffer because they want more money, because you're going to dilute the labor pool. Well, there's a number of things going on here. It's the lower you are on the economic scale, the more this is hurting you. In fact, we have a guest on at 1 a.m., Dean Baker for, what's the name of his group? The Institute for Policy Studies, I think. I hope I'm not giving the wrong group. But anyways, we'll see. Anyway, he says that it's obviously not affecting anyone at the upper levels, the middle and up. I mean, there's not going to be Salvadoran immigrants taking away accounting jobs. There's not going to be somebody from Juarez that's going to take my job. And on like that. There's not going to be someone from Honduras coming and taking a job from a doctor. That's not going to happen. So it's at the manual labor ends of it primarily, and the service jobs that are being hit. So why are these people doing this? Why the hell don't they have good jobs in their own little regions? Oh, actually, let me run this by them. I was saying this guy's been writing me these tremendously long emails, and so I said, here's one that I wrote back. I know this will sound like only an insult, but you're verging on, no, past hysteria. That's what I wrote to him. Here, we can settle this. Mark my words, and I would say this to all of you. This is why I'm reading this. Save this email. Note the date. I predict immigration will be another non-issue, one that was erected by the Bushevics. instead of the Bolsheviks. This is the Bolsheviks that throw sand in our eyes to disguise the real issues that both you and I care about. In other words, in just a few weeks or months, it will be as dead as Bush's attack on our Social Security. So that's what I'm predicting. So write it down. Now, Bruce from Dearborn, he has it in writing. But remind me. So if this is still like a big issue, you can say, yeah, you were wrong, Peter. But I don't think I am. And these are the same guys that are doing the same crap to us that they've done on every issue, one after another. The big one was when Bush was doing poorly in the polls, although this has not worked very well for him, has it? I mean, they're in such a downward spiral. They're circling the drain, as people used to say. Anyway, so Bush has said, okay, we're going to give a little something to everyone, and we are going to build a wall. I forgot how many miles, 374 miles or something like that. And they're going to have a quick fix, according to the New York Times. So guess who is going to be building this? Now, this doesn't come for free. This is going to turn out to be several billion dollars. And who do you think is going to get it? Well, of course, as the New York Times says, they're preparing to turn to a familiar administration partner, the nation's giant military contractors. Well, at least it's not Halliburton. They're not getting it. They're not getting it. But it will be Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, or Northrop Grumman. Three of the largest are among the companies that were going to submit bids within 2 weeks for a multi-billion dollar federal contract to build what the administration calls a virtual fence. So on one hand, Bush is giving more and more tax breaks to the already wealthy, the people that own Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. And those are the people that are going to make the money building this wall. What a scam. It's the same thing with this illegal wiretapping. I mean, part of it is just this naked power grab on the part of the BCF to destroy the constitutional restraints on the absolute power of the president. I mean, remember, this is what the American Revolution was against. Well, we're going back to 1775. And so part of it is, because this wiretapping doesn't work that well. I mean, these databases, and some of you written me, you're worried you're on it. I mean, they've got too much in it. They can't winnow it down to a reasonable bulk of names or records or whatever that they can actually deal with. So they wind up giving thousands and thousands and thousands of leads to the FBI that says they can't deal with them. There's too many. So one of the big things is, three things. It's a power grab by the executive, always dangerous, and what the founding fathers set up the Constitution to stop with the balance of powers. Remember that from senior class civics? So Bush is trying to destroy the Constitution, shred it in that regard. The second thing is he's trying to get the most timid of us to say, ooh, I better not oppose Bush Co. It's another thing we call them around here if you're just listening for the first time. Bush Incorporated turned the country into an economic racket for the wealthy. The most timid among us will say, well, I'm going to get on a list. I better not do it. I better not listen to Night Call on WRIF because what if they're tracking my radio or something like that? But governments always move against people that don't go for their program. So it comes with the territory. And the third thing, it's another giveaway. It's another part of the racket that Bush Co. then gives to its corporate funders. And that is these companies that are getting these contracts to do this illegal wiretapping. So it transfers again from our tax dollars, from our hard-earned wages. It takes a portion of it, and rather than doing what government should do with taxes, is return it to us in the kind of services that we need to make this a wonderful country, that it can actually say it's number one, and it is nothing in number one that means anything to us as citizens and human beings. I mean, I defy somebody to call me at 313-298-WRIF with some social index that puts us at the top. Not that we're the number one in spending on military throwaway, giveaway, whatever, the rat hole of war spending, but something that really matters, like healthcare, freedom, or people in prison, or executions, or something like that. something that we could really, infant mortality, people covered by health care, best roads, best schools, nothing. We're not number one in any of that. Because they're taking our money, and they're giving it off to their corporate buddies, and who are making billions and billions, and they're thinking, well, wait a minute, we're making billions and billions, we're going to have to pay a lot of tax. Don't worry, we're going to cut your taxes. What a scam. What an absolute scam. And just this, and then we'll start taking your calls. Top Air Force brass said to be under FBI probe. The U.S. Air Force's highest ranking officer and his predecessor are the subjects of an FBI investigation into the handling of a $50 million contract to the Thunderbirds and Air Demonstration Squadron, according to ABC News. And this is just one of how many scandals where we are just getting robbed. We're getting robbed everywhere. We're getting robbed in Congress. We're getting robbed at the gas pump. We're getting robbed when we pay our taxes. What? And do we roll over? Let's pump up the resistance. All right, right back to get your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Don't fear the reaper.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We'll do your calls now, 313-298-WRIF. I was spouting off about the Da Vinci Code. I saw it. I liked it. I'm not a Christian, so didn't affect me one way or another in terms of what it was saying about the church and its conspiracy. That's the theme of the movie and the book, of course. 40 million copies in print. Wow. And also, we were talking about immigration, and President Bush says that immigrants should learn English. Now, let's see here. Steve, who lives in Chicago, says English. We should learn Algic. I live in Chicago, and that's the language that the Native Americans who lived here spoke. So if we're expecting every immigrant to learn English, then all current Americans should learn whatever language was present in their geographical area. Learn the language, people, says Steve. Peter, sorry, but you and the other Detroiters will also have to learn Iroquoian, since that area, our area, was bilingual. Well, yeah. I never understood this. I mean, why do people care if people speak other languages? It doesn't offend me. In fact, my desire is to learn other languages so I can converse with people. Oh, I shouldn't say languages. I'd be happy if I could bring my Spanish up to operational level. So when I go back to one of those commie countries that I'm always visiting in Latin America, right? All right, here is, and we're also talking about the Da Vinci Code as well. Here is Tim in Livonia. Tim, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, man?
Hi.
Hey, I actually, I am a Christian, and I thought that the Da Vinci Code is actually a good way to reach out to other people that don't know too much about it, because basically the reason we see it as heresy or blasphemy, you know, is because the book makes the claim that Jesus had a bloodline, which we see is totally wrong. We believe he was a celibate man, and he had to do that in order to fulfill the Old Testament prophecies and become our Savior.
Yeah.
And that's basically, we give that as a reason that the book, you know, it may be a good story. It doesn't really bother me. It's fiction, but it makes a great story, and people are in an uproar of it, yeah, but it, the claim is kind of baseless that Jesus had a bloodline. I mean, that's just how we feel about it, but we feel it is a good opportunity to reach out to others and explain the story to them whenever they bring it up.
Well, as you may know, this story was not invented by Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, but rather he took it from these two authors, and they have this website, not the authors, but this publisher called Inner Traditions, and they do a lot of New Age stuff, and they have books like The Church of Mary Magdalene. And so this whole idea that there was this bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene goes back about 20 or 25 years. In fact, the two authors who wrote it sued Dan Brown in London, England, saying that he had plagiarized their theme.
Really?
They lost.
Oh, well, either way, you know, it doesn't offend me, and I don't think Christians should be in a big uproar over it, but, you know, maybe an interesting story, but that's just what we personally believe as Christians, that Jesus was a celibate man. And
Yeah, I got that one. All right, thanks a lot, Tim. I appreciate it. Good. We shouldn't get our shorts in an uproar, that's for sure. Daniel's in Macomb Township. You're on the air. Go ahead. Hey, Daniel. Hi, it's WRIF. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi.
Hi.
You know what, I just wanted to say that last caller, Jim, he was completely correct, and so were you in saying that you shouldn't get your shorts in a bunch. Let me say, it's a movie. I mean, if the fact that it's a movie, I mean, sure, he based it on real fact, but, I mean, he was a celibate man, and we should believe what you should believe, but, I mean, it was a movie. That's it. It wasn't, you know, like, take it at face value, how you will.
Yeah, well, but like I said, a little earlier, people do get very worked up when their religion is insulted. I mean, there are the cases, for instance, in India. There was this whole rebellion because Hindus were forbidden to eat cows, right?
Right.
And there was this rumor. I forget when this was, like 1920s or something. And huh? What? Okay.
1928.
You know this?
Yes.
Tell me what it was. You tell me about it then.
Well, it was, I don't know much about it. I just know the year and the fact that Gandhi had a little bit to do with it, and he helped the uproar a little bit. That's about it.
Oh, no. What I was talking about was that they had these rifles that you had to do something like twist off. Maybe it was even earlier. Twist off it with by putting it in your mouth, and then these Indian soldiers, these colonial soldiers, realized, the rumor swept them that there was cow fat on it or something like that. And there was this huge rebellion, and thousands of people were killed. Wild. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call, Daniel. Okay. Immigration it is. Jason in Pontiac. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Jason, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. How are you?
Good.
I was, telling some people that back in the, first of all, you know, for immigration, like you said earlier, I mean, all you had to do was kill an Indian and you got to become a citizen, you know, for the United States. And, but, you know, immigration policy was different back in the early 1900s. And 1900s and late 1800s when the Irish and the Italian were coming here, they were dirt poor of the country. And it wasn't like they had to meet a financial status, you know, or a standard as to where, you know, the people from darker countries that are coming now, they have to meet a financial requirement,
mm-hmm.
and they have to pass all these laws. Like, you know, like I was saying, back in the, you know, late 1800s and early 1900s, they didn't have to do that. They were like, oh, yeah, you want to become a citizen? Come on over, fill out the papers. And there wasn't really much they had to pass.
Also, there's this long history with Mexican workers of getting them into the country at different points in our history, beginning as long ago as 100 years, and when their labor was, quote, needed, and as soon as it was not needed, they were just pushed out, and it's had some awful effects on family. And in fact, in the 1930s, when there were all these Mexican workers, some, and I don't know what percentage, who had become citizens, even they were forced back into Mexico. So it's a pretty shabby history.
Yeah, and you know, also it's like, you know, they spent 200 years getting rid of Indians, you know. They don't want a bunch of Indians back into the country, because I don't know if you noticed that 90% of Mexico can claim that they're Native American ancestral descent from, like, the Aztecs, Mayans, Chapas, Yaquis, Apaches, Comanches, you know, and, you know, they're brown skin, and you know, this land has been taken from them twice, once as Indians, you know, when the Spanish came, and twice as Americans, or twice as Mexicans when the Americans took California and, you know, Texas and such, you know, and you know, these people, they come here to work hard, and, you know, if they could get the paper like the Italians and the Irish did, they would do that. They would go through that way. But, you know, they're like, you know, as soon as brown skin people started coming more, they had to set up a system on how to make it not look racist, and then they had to,
it's a lot stricter. You're absolutely right. All right, Jason, thank you very much. Times have changed, and immigration has always been a burr under the saddle. Boy, I should be able to get a better analogy than that. But the people, our people, you and me, Euro-Americans, I know not all of you are, but us Euro-Americans, we almost all were from ethnic groups that were reviled at one point or another. And in fact, you wouldn't even imagine it. I think I remember talking about this a couple of weeks ago. We're saying that there was such a flood of Irish, and they would come into the United States. In fact, remember from that movie Gangs in New York, many of them were just put immediately into the U.S. Army, sometimes fighting Indians, sometimes fighting during the Mexican War, sometimes fighting for the Civil War. For the Union side, during the Civil War, I forgot what percentage of the Union Army were immigrants. I mean, very high. Anybody know that? 313-298-WRIF. Was it over 50%? It's very possible. I wanted to read this because you say, well, what kind of alternatives do you have? I mean, it's pretty tough. Here, let's see, who's this? Oscar Chacon. Chacon? I suppose. Alternatives to a wall. How NAFTA and other corporate-friendly trade policies displace farmers and create mass migration. So this is, without reading you the article, it's all there. You have NAFTA, this North American a free trade agreement, which is free for the owners, for the corporations, for the people that are making billions off of this, and it destroys indigenous farmers, the local farm economies, which are now inundated with genetically modified corn, for instance, in Mexico, and U.S. beans in Colombia. So this works real well for American growers. And again, it's not like a family farm. These are these huge agribusinesses that have driven American family farmers off of American land, and now it drives Mexican and Colombian and everywhere else throughout Latin America, those farmers off their land, so they flood into these cities. These cities now are millions and millions and millions of people, led by Mexico City, which I think is at 21 or 22 million. So this is where it all lies. Julio Huatos, who is a researcher at the City University of New York Howard Samuels Center, while the U.S. workers are entitled to and should exercise their democratic right to regulate the pace of social change. So now, get this. This guy is saying that we have a right to have social change, which has to do also with the economic positioning of us regarding jobs and income and all that. He says, as opposed to being passive victims of blind economic forces, it must be recognized that no trade policy reform can change the brutal realities that underlie foreign competition, the gigantic disparities in wealth, productivity, wages, and living standards that prevail in today's world. If the U.S. workers want to exercise a democratic control over the global economic phenomena that disrupts their lives, they need to address the deeper cause, which is world inequality. And it doesn't mean that we, 98%, 99% of the people listening to this program, should get poorer, or that we ought to be rewarded less for the labor that we do. It means that at the top, there is such a disproportionate hogging of the world's wealth and resources that it distorts that below it. Now, we were always this great privileged sector of the world, and for all practical purposes, we remain. But it's beginning to fray greatly around the edges. And it's very possible what many of you fear correctly could be in process. And that is that we're going to wind up with a picture of the United States in the years to come that looks like other American countries throughout Latin America. And that is a well-waged, privileged third of the country with the bottom two-thirds really doing crappy. And one of the things we can do, we can hope and we can scheme individually to make sure that we wind up in the third, top third, but it's a crapshoot. It's a crapshoot. And would it be easier if there was a little fairness in the world? That we don't need anybody getting a $400 million retirement package based on us being gouged at the gas pump? I mean, that's just the most recent obscene example of how wealth is distributed in this world. Okay. All right, let me get back to your calls. 313-298-WRIF. Okay, let me see. Where are we going to go? Here's Gerardo in Detroit. Am I saying your name right?
Close enough.
Okay.
Sure. Well, you know what? I wanted to really congratulate the person who called the first individual regarding the Da Vinci Code, because that individual is a very good example of what a Christian is. I could say many different names of people who are like huge political figures, televangelists, whoever. And I'm not going to say names or anything, but many of them, it's like they just don't come across with the love that the Bible speaks or teaches. I mean, they just intimidate, you know. And like Jesus expressed love. Love, come to love, here's love, you know, not hate, you're going to hell, all this, you know, persecution and all that. And it seemed like I do congratulate that individual, because that's what people need to see. Christians are not people who start wars, okay?
I don't know. Isn't there a guy named George W. Bush?
Yeah, but you know what? I went to church today, too. And, of course, you know, it was like, there was a crime that was almost committed, in a church parking lot. And for some reason, the people pointed to me to go out and to be the soldier in the parking lot and to prevent anything else from happening, which was kind of unusual. But, I mean, it's like, sure, you know, there comes a time, even in a Christian's life, when you have to stand up against aggression in one way or another. But a good way to tell, either if you're listening to, like, some people are going to uphold the Da Vinci Code over the Bible.
Yeah.
Because if you listen to a person, they may speak and say, like, when the first words that come out of their mouth, you know what I hate is fill in the blank. You know I hate fill in the blank. You know, and it's like when you hear that first, when somebody starts a subject, starts a sentence, it's like that's kind of giving you an idea of, you know, of what their comment is going to be.
Well, sure.
You know, and sometimes you just got to say, well, thank you for your opinion. Oh, but real quick.
Sure.
What it was, the British Army, everybody knows and seen in a movie how you would load up a musket, okay?
Right.
So the British Army was trying to help the Indian Army. Well, I believe they were Hindu. And what it is that instead of having a powder horn, you know, like with a musket, everybody visualize that right now. You pour in the powder,
okay,
ramrod,
short version of it, yeah.
Okay, well, what it is that they used to make before bullets, the bullet cartridge and all that.
Well, this was the technology that came between muskets and modern rifle shells, right. All right, I got to move on, Gerardo, so thank you very much for your comments. I appreciate it. Let's see here. We were talking about what percentage, thanks to Lisa, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, 1 million of the Union soldiers, 45% of all Union soldiers were native-born Americans of British ancestries. 23% of all Union soldiers were Germans. Many of them, of course, were fleeing the oppression there. 210,000, 10% almost, were African-American, and on and on. It gives a whole breakdown here. So, I don't know, we're born in Canada, born in England, this doesn't entirely answer what percent. I guess if 45.4% of all Union soldiers were native-born Americans, that means that 56% were not. Yeah. All right, someone wants to take me up on my challenge. All right, it's Mitchell in Wyandotte. Mitchell, hey, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. I just have two comments about you challenged us earlier to find out or to explain how America was number one in the world. And the first one I was thinking of would be just overall civil freedom. If you look around at the world, there are countries. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, for one thing, one thing is our opinion. The other thing is how we're ranked. Well, we're ranked about 17th or 18th by these people that do this in political freedoms. And we're certainly above Kazakhstan or something like that, but way below most European countries and Scandinavian countries and Canada and places like that. There is so much political surveillance going on in this country by police forces and the FBI and unwarranted wiretapping. I don't think you're going to get real far with that one.
Well, I'm sure we can talk about that. You don't have time for that, I understand. Okay, well, screw that then.
All right.
Second one. My second one would be economic. And I know you're going to say, you know, about, like you were talking a little bit earlier about how, like, soon, at least if we keep going the way we are, then there's going to be the upper third.
Yeah.
You know, and then the bottom two are going to be completely poor. But if you're looking at it just, I don't know, like, I don't have statistics at my fingertips, but if you're looking at it, I'm looking around, you know, downriver, I'm looking around Metro Detroit, and there are so many small businesses, there are so many...
Well, you can't do it anecdotally. In terms of whether you're talking about class mobility or ability for people to improve their status or distribution of wealth, the United States comes in dead last statistically among all of the industrial countries, so not number one there either. And I got to do these before midnight, so thank you.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thanks a lot. It's midnight in Detroit, and we're broadcasting all over the world. So who knows what time it is where you are, but right here, where most of our audience is, listening on the radio at least, it's midnight, 1 a.m. Eastern time. We're going to be talking with Dean Baker. Dean Baker is the co-author of a new book, and he's going to talk a bit about immigration. So he's pretty interesting, relevant to what we've been talking about here. We're also talking about the Da Vinci Code. And if you like, when you email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, put what city you're writing from. You don't have to. For some reason or other, you're paranoid because of what's been happening in this country, because we're not number one in political freedoms. And that's what I was asking some people, too. What are we number one in? What are we number one in? I mean, people used to say that all the time. I think it was in the 80s. Number one, number one. Well, I don't think we're number one in hardly anything that's good. I'm trying to think. It must be, right? Now, I like living here where I do. But, okay, you tell me. 313-298-WRIF. Rod writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Regarding the Da Vinci Code, my opinion, sex isn't bad unless misused or abused. So why would it be bad for the Christian founder to have offspring? I think people might have a problem with this due to the fact that sex has been put off as a bad thing in the past, and this opinion somehow got caught up with their founder. So it therefore wouldn't be okay to some for Jesus to have had sex. He says, who cares? Well, at some level, I say, who cares as well. But you got to remember, the foundation of the whole story is that Jesus came to save us. He was the Savior. He was the Christ to redeem us from our inherently sinful nature. Original sin. Because Adam and Eve went for it. I mean, geez, you see a naked woman. What the hell? I mean, how old were they? Weren't they fairly young? And they're naked? You say, all right. I mean, that's too much of a temptation. Plus, God being omniscient, all-seeing, knew it was going to happen. Right? He had to know that his little experiment of paradise was going to go down the carnal drain because he can see everything. You know, he knows when you are, what is that? Doesn't he knows when you are, no, it's some other. That's some other story. Sex then becomes, I don't know, I wonder, that's interesting. I mean, no, there's got to be a lot of books about it. But why sex, which is so pleasurable and has the function of propagating the species, why it's gotten such a bad name in all organized religion? I think it has a lot to do with the fact that most organized religions, in fact, all, are patriarchal. And guys were always worried about women having sex on their terms. That's, you know, that's why they don't like pagans. That's why they always try to suppress pagans. You got to remember, for all of us Euro-Americans, those of us whose ancestry goes to Europe, that's really our core religion, paganism. Paganism. That's the European religion. And there's a lot of sensuality in that, particularly around, what is it, Beltane? Is that come and gone? That's that's around May Day, the festival of rebirth and sexuality and seeds and germination. Makes a lot more sense to me if you're going to go that route. But hey, it's up to you. Okay, but it's organized religion and patriarchal religion. Sky gods have had a bad history on the planet, I'd say. And I know a lot of you are, quote, good Christians and are only loving and do good things. And I've always say the only Christians that I know personally know are people that are involved in very dramatic ways with the peace and social justice movement. In fact, there was just a meeting that a number of them went to the Progressive Spirituality Network, I think, Progressive Spirituality Network, something like that. So, I mean, they're there. But overall, the history of Christianity and Hindu and Muslim has been a bloody sword. I mean, that's the history. I just want to do this real quickly. This really broke my heart. And I hope it's okay that I mention your name. It's to me, and it says, my name is Mike Boyd, and I've attached a flyer with this letter to you. We are putting on a fundraising benefit for a friend's wife that we went to school with. She was diagnosed with breast cancer recently, and they need to help with medical costs. I was wondering if we could put something on WRIF on letting our friends know about this. We've been trying to contact people we went to school with and having not the best of luck. We graduated in 1980, so I know your station is listened to by us from the 80s. To have this broadcast over WRIF would be awesome and help out very much. We're trying to get 500 people to come out to the spaghetti dinner we are having. Please contact me at the below numbers, which I will not read. But I will tell you that this is going to happen Saturday, June 3rd. It's going to be at the VFW Romanowski Post on Joy Road in Westland, Michigan. $10 a ticket only gets you all this food. And it's to help Ruth Schultz. And family and friends are doing all they can to help defray their medical costs. Now, two things strike me. Just how wonderful friends are and how important your community is and how good Mike Boyd and these folks are. The other thing is, why in the hell do we, after what we pay in taxes, have to be forced to have spaghetti dinners to get someone the medical care that they need? Why isn't this available as a matter of right? Why, instead of hundreds of millions, which turn into billions, which eventually even has turned into trillions, be siphoned off of what we earn, both through low wages and through taxes, off into these military contractors that are going to be building a wall on the border or getting a $400 million retirement package off of what we paid at the gas pump? I mean, why wouldn't Lee Hamilton, who's getting from the retiring CEO of ExxonMobil, write a check, Lee, you son of a bitch? This makes me so angry that if this doesn't work, she's not going to get the medical care. Well, we sure aren't number one in this, are we? All right. Let's go back. And if you're listening, Mike, I didn't even tell you I was going to do this. I will call you tomorrow or so. All the way from Pittsburgh, here is Todd. Todd, it's Peter Werbe, and you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great. Thanks for calling in.
First time I heard your show, it's wonderful. I agree with most of what you say.
Good.
Immigration. It doesn't seem like we really want to fix the immigration problem because we keep on keeping Mexico poor due to the immense amount of debt that they've built up to us, and we won't forgive the debt. So it just makes it a terrible place to live for them, so they have to come here. It seems like a giant excuse to militarize the borders.
Well, it's part of a whole strategy that keeps wages low here, there, rather, as you're saying correctly, and then keeps wages low at the bottom of the economic scale and a lot of industrial jobs as well.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, and these, though, we have to realize that these people, though, are not our enemy, but they are our fellow workers. And they and we should be struggling jointly against our common enemy, the people that are exploiting us.
Well, actually, for them, they have to unionize for themselves. In America, we sacrificed many lives trying to get a decent wage for ourselves.
Sure.
It wasn't too many years ago children were going down in the mines to get coal. And they have to go through the whole process of unionizing and getting respect for what they do with their lives.
Now, I think we're going to need some unionization here as well, again, because the unionization that we have now, what is it, down to like 12% of us? I mean, I'm a union member, but we're getting to be pretty rare birds. It's got to be some mass industrial organizing like there were in the 1930s, or as I was saying earlier, what the industrial workers of the world, and that's even more important. Because the capitalists, the bosses, the owners, the corporate CEOs, they're international. They enforce these international agreements to their benefit. They have this great class solidarity, this great class consciousness, this idea of class warfare, which they practice upon us. And we say, oh, keep our fellow workers out of here so we can, you know, whatever, which doesn't work, and they're not interested in doing that. You're absolutely right. Well, hey, thanks for joining us from Pittsburgh. Please do it again. I appreciate that. Here's Alex in South Lyon. Alex, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
All right. Just wanted to comment on what you spoke about earlier, making America the number one country in the world. And I think there's nothing that makes America the number one country in the world. I absolutely agree with you. We're wrong on a number of different levels. And personally, I think America is a book being judged by its cover.
Which is... a guy named George W. Bush.
Absolutely.
That's the cover.
And certain men before him, but definitely no. Absolutely no.
Well, it's interesting. I was just looking at this Knight Ridder account, wire services. Americans don't like President Bush personally much anymore either. So first it was his political policies that have gone into such disfavor. Recent poll for the New York Times and CBS showed that 29% of us had a favorable opinion of Bush, while 55% had an unfavorable position. So how would you like it, or how would I like it, Alex, if you found out that 55% of your friends didn't like you, thought you were just really a bad character? That'd be pretty bad, wouldn't it?
I definitely think so. I mean, the approval ratings, it's just like, you know, when it comes down to voting with popular vote, more people can vote for someone, but electorally they can continue to be elected, or as a majority, you know, like 51% on 49. What, you know, like how do these things happen here? And it's supposed to be equal, free, just.
Yeah, well, a recent Gallup poll for USA Today showed that 39%, this is higher, had a favorable opinion of Bush, but 60% of us had an unfavorable opinion. Wait a minute, it says see page 2. I write these little notes for myself here. Gallup, for example, found drops in the number of people who think that Bush is honest and trustworthy, and that he shares their values, and that he cares about people like them. I mean, who could be so self-deluded that they think that this rich kid that was born on third base and thinks he hit a triple, who's screwed up everything he's ever done in his entire life, that he would share our values and that he actually cares about the average person? He cares about the ultra-rich, of which he is.
Yeah, what do they call the top five? You know, like, you know, they said that you're the top one third. You know, the one third, like you spoke about, it's ridiculous. And like a president that's got the most vacation time out of any president in history. You know, just like you said, born with a silver spoon in his mouth.
Yeah. All right, Alex. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. I used a different analogy. I didn't say silver spoon. What's that Who song? I was born with a plastic spoon in my mouth. Yeah. And what about him being honest here? Despite pledge, taxes increase for teenagers. Remember, there's just this big giveaway to the ultra wealthy. It could have been a better deal for the average American. You got to remember this, right? I mean, is there any of you Bush supporters that do not care that your pocket is being picked? So, there's, how much is it, $69 billion that, reduces taxes by $69 billion, almost the important proportion of it going to the ultra wealthy, people that do not need tax breaks. This is supposed to be, invigorating the economy. Well, how about you, the person that's listening, making $30,000 a year? If you got a tax break, say they just said, we're going to put a $30,000 exemption, period, so you wouldn't have to pay any taxes, what would you do with your money? What would you go spend it, right? What about if you made $40,000, $50,000, same thing? So this is just economic insanity. The whole thing is just being run by pathological greed heads, power mongers. The $69 million tax cut bill that Bush signed this week tripled tax rates for teenagers with college saving funds. I mean, when I went to college, it was pretty inexpensive. I could handle it. But now it is so expensive, I can't even imagine how anybody other than an upper middle class family is going to make it. And those of you with small kids that are putting money into funds figure, well, I got to start, the kid's 2 years old, I better start saving for his college. Well, you should. But the bill that Bush signed triples the tax rate for teenagers with college savings funds, despite Bush's 1999 pledge to veto any tax increase. Under the new law, teenagers 14 to 17 with investment income will now be taxed at the same rate as their parents, not at their own rates. Long-term capital gains and dividends had been taxed at 5%, will now be taxed at 15%. Interest that had been taxed at 10% will now be taxed as much as 35%. So this is what's happening in Bush's America. A teenager with a college fund that is an investment income is going to be taxed up to one-third of it in Bush's America. who are these people that still support Bush? I just can't even imagine it. Yikes. All right, let me try this. Okay, we'll go to this one. Here's Jerry in Detroit. Jerry, it's Peter Werby on WRIF, and you're on the air with me.
Hi, thank you. Well, I want to thank you for putting my website on your listener list. And what I wanted to talk about...
Well, remind me which one it is, because I got a lot of them.
Watch.
You know what?
Watch.
Wait. I keep talking over you. When I say go, say it. Go.
HartmanWatchWatch.blogspot.com.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it actually, if you go to it, it just says Hartman Watch.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So if you go, people, I don't know how many people visit this. If you go to my website, which is Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerby.com, there's listener websites, and so I list them all. But let me tell you something about Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman is, I don't know how he does what he does. He's a morning show host in Portland, Oregon, does a talk show. He then does a nationally syndicated show at noon Eastern time. Plus, he lectures. He writes columns for lots of different places, websites and what have you. And he's just about to come out with another one of his books.
Yeah, he pulled all day or once even during the filibuster. He was on, I can't remember the name. But what I wanted to talk about, so I didn't want to waste my clock, was NSA. The wiretapping. I was watching the testimony, and this guy Hayden, the way he's twitching at the mouth and sweating, especially in the last round of questioning, what he wanted to bring into secret session was the internet tapping. That's what's the big secret. See, Jose Padilla, he's in jail.
Yeah.
No trial. He was surfing the internet. Anybody can look that case up.
Okay.
He was surfing the internet looking for technology. And during the testimony, he weaseled around that by saying, well, it was because of the technologies that were that we had in the 70s when the FISA Act was written and the technologies we have today, which is what, the internet. Well, we can't really go into that into the open session. We have to go into secret session. So it's actually nuts and bolts of it. It's the internet because it's the World Wide Web. Okay, once you're connected...
Let me clear a few things up. I don't... You may be saying some things that aren't entirely clear. What we're talking about is the nomination proceedings in front of the U.S. Senate of General Hayden. So this Army officer, or this Air Force officer, is being proposed by Bush to replace this absolute last disaster that replaced the disaster before that, the guy that proceeded over 9/11 and that Bush gave a Medal of Freedom to. I can't. What the hell is his name, Jerry? I can't remember suddenly.
Porter Goss.
No, the guy.
No.
He was the last.
I'll remember. Let's not waste time.
Anyways, he said that the weapons of mass destruction. He's the guy that said the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were a slam dunk. So you got this Hayden guy, and he's been running the warrantless wiretaps for the National Security Agency. Any warrant is easily gotten through the Federal Intelligence Security Act courts that are set up, the FISA courts. But Bush, again, wants to erode supervisory power of another branch of government, in this case, the courts. He also is ignoring the supervision of intelligence committees that are another branch of government. So what he is attempting to do is destroy the balance of power and privilege completely the executive branch, which is what I said earlier. That's what the American Revolution was all about.
I'd like to make a small request. I know that's not a music line, so what I'd hope for is... maybe another or a repeat of your interview with Pun Plamondon, please.
Okay, well, maybe I can do that. Pun Plamondon, who has a great autobiography, and if I had a memory, do you remember what the name of it is, Jerry? Oh, Lost to the Mohicans, I think.
Ottawa.
Lost to the Ottawa.
Ottawa.
Lost to the Ottawas. Pun Plamondon, he was an old pal of mine going way back in the day, and a great autobiography about Detroit in the 60s and the 70s and John Sinclair and the White Panther Party. And if none of that means anything to you, check it out. Or if you don't get any of it, email me and I'll send you a link to it. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Jerry, thanks. Appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Let's see, here's Jim and Taylor. Jim, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, I wanted to address the immigration issue.
Sure.
Yeah, well, there's so many facets that you could basically go at on this issue. One is the San Quentin prison. There's people in the prison, and basically, you know, they made mistakes when they were young and not in prison for the rest of their life, which is not right, you know, because what people do when they're young, of course, you know, they can be influenced by a lot of things. And there was one guy that was supposed to be like Randy Johnson. He was a pretty good pitcher, Chris Rich. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Hmm.
But he was one of the nation's top prospects, you know,
okay,
in the 70s and the early 80s. And basically he took him. He took his team to the Collegiate World Series and posted a very low ERA, and he ended up murdering his wife. But now he's like 46 years old, and basically, you know, in there for life. You know, basically one mistake, and it, you know, ruined his life.
Well, that's well. On one hand, that's a pretty big mistake. But the United States, again, in terms of we were talking about what number one is, certainly not number one in compassion. We have some of the longest jail sentences for people, and that murder is not punished anywhere near as harshly in the European countries or in Canada, for instance, than it is here in the United States. And that's always, I mean, I've thought about that a lot. It's very interesting that you bring that up, Jim, because I was thinking sometimes they're going after these, and they're still alive, these concentration camp guards that were like 85 years old, or 85 years old now, and when they were 20, and they were just this crazy, brutal, murderous, torturous young man, vile, that committed vile acts of mass murder and all sorts of other things. Is it the same person 65 years later? I don't know. Or but can a crime like that or like murder be erased? I don't know.
Yeah, I believe they can be given a chance. They need to, you know, educate these people and try to rehabilitate them, which they're not trying to do right now.
Now, well, actually, murderers have the least recidivist rate, are the least apt to repeat their act. All right, Jim, thanks. That's a good point to bring up. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Scott in Westland. Scott, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Good.
As usual, I'm going to try and hit, you know, two topics. But the first one is I want to talk about why methanol, that's with an M, methyl alcohol or wood alcohol, is a bad form of alternative energy. And also, if we could get to it, I'd like to talk about why Vatican birth control policies are responsible for our problems with Mexican immigration.
Well, let's do the second one first.
Okay, well, just very quickly, this is basically not a new idea. You know, it's going back to Paul Ehrlich in his Population Bomb, the book, and also, of course, there still is an organization called Zero Population Growth.
Right.
And obviously, when you look at, you know, why are so many people immigrating from Mexico? Well, it's because Mexico is overpopulated, okay? And when you look at the developing countries in the world now that are getting ahead, like China, India, and yes, even Iran, they have very aggressive national birth control policies. And so, but even in China, which has the most draconian one, really, they don't say don't have any children. They say have one, okay? You know, and so that's what I would say that...
I'll tell you, among poor people, it's really hard to get birth control working, both because of its availability and also that there's value seen in large families. But, I mean, I don't know that Mexico is overpopulated. It's overpopulated only in the sense as it relates to the aggregate national income. In other words, the Netherlands is has an extraordinarily higher population density than Mexico, right?
But
no one thinks of that as overpopulated. You know, wait a minute. Do me a favor, Scott. Don't say anything for like half a second. There's something when you start talking that your phone sounds terrible. We have to cut you loose on it. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. Here is Bill. Bill's in Southfield. Bill, hi. It's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Okay. Hello there, Peter. I wanted to ask about one of the news stories that was on about a week ago, and it was one of the ultra-conservative right-wingers, and he was saying that they actually had proof that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and that he was paying off, you know, the United Nations to turn their eyes to that. And I, you know, wanted to get your opinion. And he said it's part of a worldwide conspiracy that, you know, that they're conspiring against the United States. I don't believe that myself. But
well,
why would the rest of the world want to conspire against us?
Yeah, I don't think so. But yeah, I mean, it's these guys can't give it up. They even Bush has admitted that there are no weapons of mass destruction. That now what they've fallen back on that it wasn't purposeful, that it wasn't a lie, that they'd gotten bad information, and that's why they're going to reorganize the CIA to give better intelligence and what have you. I mean, I think that they purposely lied. They knew there was no way in the world that there were no weapons of mass destruction. I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. How about you? Did you know that?
Oh, yeah. I didn't think that they had it.
Well, how come you and I, Bill, knew what was going on, and Donald Rumsfeld didn't, and all the rest of those folks didn't?
Well, they wanted to go off to war and make money.
There you go. There it is. Thank you. We needn't say another thing. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. Here is Mark in Monroe. Mark, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing great.
Excuse me. I've got static on my end, so if you hear that, that's a problem with my phone here.
I don't hear it.
Okay, good. I just want to talk about the Da Vinci Code a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I think the religious community's knee-jerk reaction on this book, The Da Vinci Code, is because Dan Brown is making so much money on the Christian scam. And the biggest yeah. difference between the Da Vinci Code and the Bible is, my gosh, at least people have read the Da Vinci Code. You know, a lot of people don't even have the slightest idea what is in the Bible, and they're just afraid to question this false reality. You've had several people calling in praising Jesus, but I guess if a person really took a look, this guy Jesus didn't even exist. He's a fictional character, just like Zeus and Isis and Thor. He's just a fictional character. And I went and saw the movie Da Vinci Code. I thought mm-hmm. it was pretty interesting.
Had you read the book?
You know, I haven't.
Okay, well, I was just curious. So, yeah. So because I don't know if you heard me earlier, but I was saying I'd read the book.
Okay.
So I didn't have any surprises, and I knew who the bad guy was.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I missed the first few minutes of your show. So anyway, and you know, also about this, what is America number one? I guess we're the number one empire, and I would say that we reached that point after World War II, when Britain had to take a step down the economic ladder, and us going around the South America, Central America primarily, and propping up these puppet dictators, Augusto Pinochet and the Somozas and the Duvalier family, all these chumps that we propped up. It's no wonder we're number one.
Empire.
Empire on the planet, exactly.
But we're talking about good things, Mark. Now, I can tell both from the location and your name and what you've said, you must be my old pal, Mark, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Well, I haven't talked to you in a long time. Email. You have email?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just send me an email and I'll get in touch with you tomorrow.
Will do, Peter.
All right.
Take care.
Great to hear from you. Yeah, this show has been good for that. I can't begin to tell you how many people from throughout my life I've been able to recontact through all of this. I should go to a break, but I want to hear this. Here's Jason in Troy. Jason, hey, it's Peter Werbe.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
A proud union member you're talking to.
Okay, excellent. I wanted to say that I'm not saying what your point or direction with your unionization is wrong. I think it does make sense, but you have to look around and find that it's not necessarily going to be appropriate in different industries. I think the UAW industry or the UAW has just completely thrown that union, that whole union and that whole industry into a state of disarray because of pushing too much. They got too much And then now.
Wait, wait. Do you think it doesn't have anything to do with the management? I mean, even if they, quote, got too much, and I don't think they got too much at all. I mean, I've got my problems with the UAW. I used to work for the UAW. I used to broadcast for them. I got plenty of things to say about them. But ultimately, the people that are running it, that have the real economic power, that made the economic decisions, are the guys in the suits. And they had the capacity to say, hey, we can't afford this agreement. They signed on to it. And a lot of other companies throughout the world that have strong automobile unions, like in Japan and Korea, and they're doing just fine. You don't think it may be in the lap of the management of General Motors and Ford and what have you? I mean, they're trying to use the unions as scapegoats for their inability to compete.
I agree. That's not the only reason, but I think that the UAW is a major piece of the puzzle. When you really take a look at why things are crumbling.
Yeah, I don't agree. But see, one thing is, let's say you're right. Let's say you're right, for sake of argument. Well, that means essentially that we're living under the system of blackmail. That in order to retain your job, you're going to have to submit to low wages. That while the stockholders get richer and richer, because the rich are getting richer, statistically, there's no doubt about it, that there's a transfer, there's a tremendous transfer worldwide and in this country of money flowing to the already wealthy. The poor are getting poorer, so that goes on. So essentially, what this argument turns out to be is that we ought to put our hats in our hands, don't organize in any way, and take whatever the bosses give us.
No, I don't. I agree with you on that point. I was watching a special on 60 Minutes last week, and I can't remember the guy's name, but he's put together a phenomenally successful union for janitors. I forgot. You know who I'm talking about, right?
I do indeed. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I watched that, and I thought, wow, unions can be a positive thing. But then you look at the problems or the differences between that and some of the other unions that have been around a long time and have really been reaping the benefits. You look at that union, that to me is healthy. The old needs to go. We need more real, true unions that really do truly represent the people.
Well, I think one of the that we ought to get back to, most of the unions call themselves internationals. In fact, that's usually the headquarters, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, or the I don't even know if they call themselves any of that anymore, the International United Auto Workers. And we got to realize that Ford or General Motors, which I believe General Motors is the largest employer in Mexico, paying people $2.50 an hour or something like that, then we got to get on board and start having international unions again that demand a worldwide living wage. There's enough wealth in the entire world. This is like the 19th century, where you had the workers working 12 and sometimes even 14 hours a day in hovels, owing everything that they made to the company's store, and worldwide, that's the picture that has occurred again, because the model of early industrialization, which occurred in Europe and the United States, and we had to fight for an eight-hour day and get shot down in the streets. We had to fight for unions to get shot down in the streets, and on and on. That's a struggle. I don't mean that people should get shot down worldwide, although they are in a lot of countries when they try to form unions, is that we need to reinvigorate that idea that we cannot just be looted of the wealth that our labor produces. Hey, I got to move on. I'm way late on speaking of money. I got to pay some bills here, and we'll be right back. Thanks for your call. We'll be right back with our final segment. There's some open lines right now for the first time tonight, so if you have any comments on immigration or Jason was just talking about unions, or we've talked about a lot, or the Da Vinci Code, anything like that. 313-298-WRIF.
Got a buck? Get a song.
Can I get a holla, holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. Welcome back to our final segment of Night Call. And at 1 a.m., which is about 20 minutes from now, we'll be talking with Dean Baker. He's going to be talking about his new book and some about, don't go away from the radio, about economics, because essentially that's what we're talking about. Who gets the money? Let's see. Jeremy the Squirrel writes in to calltalkyes at yahoo.com about the Da Vinci Code, like Sir Ian McKellen, who was plays a role in there. His response to critics saying the... he says the Bible should come with a disclaimer labeling it as fiction. I think that says that on my website even. We're also talking about what, there's a, that quote is on my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. We're talking about what is the United States number one in? Tim, listening in Danbury, Connecticut, says, we're probably number one in the number of TV channels we have on our cable and satellite systems. Okay. Here is Tom in Ann Arbor. This is all email now. I was just looking at your website and noticed an error that needs attention. About part of the way down your homepage, you have a header saying, Bush tells the truth for once, linking to a story about Bush's best moment in office. He told an interviewer in Bild, which is a newspaper, of Germany, that it was catching a 7.5-pound perch in his own lake at the Crawford compound. So that, they asked him, what was the best moment in your presidency, and he said catching a 7.5-pound perch. Well, according to Tom here, the North American record for a freshwater perch is 4 pounds 3 ounces, so once again he lied. It's in caps. This is yet another bit of evidence that he is a pathological liar, backing up Mark Crispin Miller's position elaborated in the Bush Dyslexicon. Every statement of fact that he utters is absolutely and unequivocally false in my experience. And here's a link to the State of Maryland DNR that mentions the record. All right. Dune writes in what respect is America number one? Simple, cojones. Think about the type of crap folks like Rumsfeld think they can get away with and usually do. One more, Pam and Wyandotte writes, please let your listeners know about Baghdad ER, which premiered tonight on HBO. It was hard to watch, and I was angrier than I've ever been watching it, but it should be required viewing for every citizen. I don't see how anyone could come away from this documentary and still defend this horrible war. It's called Baghdad ER, and it's about this emergency room in Baghdad. And I'll tell you, Pam, I read enough about it to... let me say that I'm not going to watch it. I'm sure HBO will run it several times in the near future. If enough people see it, we may actually get massive numbers of protesters in the street. No, no, forget about the war. It's all about immigration, right? All right. Here's Brian in Lincoln Park. Brian, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing good.
All right. Actually, what I want to say is, as far as immigration goes, I do believe that... you know, we should go ahead and put up some type of border with our troops, but you got to understand that the people that are coming in here, I understand that they're doing jobs that we don't want to do, but I also heard on this show that there was a lady in Los Angeles that was offering up a job for $35 an hour to do landscaping. Well, here in Michigan, if you offer someone that job for $35 an hour, they're going to take it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the income level is so different that here in Michigan for $35 an hour, you'd have people jumping at that.
I might consider it. I like to do landscaping.
Well, I mean, not you particularly.
Well, yeah, what the hell? $35 an hour?
Well, what I'm saying is I am in landscaping, and normally they hire you in at $16 an hour.
Uh-huh.
And she's saying at 35 she couldn't get any legal person to take it.
Wow.
That she had to hire illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
And this is on Drew and Mike. I mean, this is your program.
Well, it has to be true.
If
Drew and Mike said it,
well, no, it doesn't have to be true, but, I mean, this is actually news that they said, and to me it's just unbelievable.
I'm not even sure what it says, though. The only thing that would say to me is that there's a labor shortage, right?
Well, that's what I don't understand. How can you sit there and tell me that someone's not going to take a job for $35 an hour?
It's kind of hard to believe. I mean, if you think about 35, I'm too tired all of a sudden to do the math if it doesn't have a lot of zeros in it. Say it was only 30, that's $240 a day, that's 100,025, so that's like 60 grand a year. Come on. I mean, people would be quitting their jobs in the casinos to take it. All right, Brian, I got to rush through some calls. Thanks for that. Drew and Mike, yeah, well, they're great sources of information usually. Here is Christina in Romulus. Christina, hi. Peter Werby, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to touch base on what another gentleman was talking about earlier, on the fact that some of the people that go to jail when they're younger in their ages and then feel remorse for the crimes they committed, more specifically murderers, and he thinks they should be released later. The bottom line, I think, is they've taken a life regardless of if they feel bad about it later on or not. They're still not God, and they're still not supposed to have the choice of whether the life is taken or not.
You know, I'll tell you, Christine, it doesn't seem like, for instance, although there are some exceptions, in Europe we have the kind of monstrous killings that we have here. Maybe some guy just walked in, where was it today, somewhere into church and just killed five people. I mean, what's up with that? And then 6 or 7 years, he says, you know, geez, I made a mistake. I was really sorry about that. Well, go ahead.
The only other countries that I know where they condone that is in the Middle East, where they condone murders as, you know, a prideful thing, as, you know, opposed to being something that's looked down upon and, you know, even... Well, considered a crime for it.
Yeah, they're not real big on murders there either, although it does seem to be happening with quite a bit of frequency there now, doesn't it? But, well, that's what I was asking. I mean, what when someone does something when they're 18 or 20 years old, and then, I don't know, should they stay there until they're 85? But I had one other thought, which seems to be lost, but it may come to me once again. Thank you, Christine. I'm going to go through these calls kind of fast so we can get everybody on. Thank you for that. No, that's part of the ambiguity. I mean, do you not keep people for their life when they get sentenced to life? I mean, in Europe, people get sentenced 7-8 years in jail for murder. But I think usually these are crimes of passion. There's like always about, I don't want to exaggerate, but there's a great number of serial killers functioning at any given time in the United States. I was going to say 60. Maybe it is. I don't know. At least 30. So you have, there's something about, that's what we're number one in. The United States is number one in serial killers. So we did find another thing that the United States is number one in. Here's in Mike in Macomb County. Mike Kai, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Huge fan, buddy.
Well, thank you.
Good work.
Thank you.
I'd actually just like to know what we, as anti-Bushco, should do to get rid of this thug. Because, you know, I'm really tired about hearing these compromises and local protests that are going on. We need to take this nationally, you know. We need to take it to the streets of Washington. There needs to be millions. Something has to be resolved, because it's just really, it's really making my ass red.
Well, I'll tell you what happens, Mike. I think we're in a period now, unfortunately, of great fatigue. We should compliment ourselves, the critics of Bushco, of the Bush crime family, the BCF, because we started off at this incident, this terrible incident in our history, where Bush had like 90% approval rating, and which is, to me, is absolutely just it's incredulous to me that someone who allowed 9/11 to occur by his inattentiveness, who was warned time and time again that this was going to happen and had information in front of his face, and he decided to go on vacation, that still he wound up with a 90% approval rating. Well, everyone now, except for who I call the fascist third, and even some of those have peeled off as well, don't like him personally and think his policies are disastrous. So we have been responsible for that. Because you got to remember that the press was not into criticizing him. The media was not into, you know, the television was not into criticizing Bush. And it was only because of the doggedness of the critics of Bush that we have gotten to a point where he should be down the drain, circling it, in the toilet with his, when people have finally caught on to what Bush is all about. But the big question is what you raise, Mike, is the important one. How do we take this mass consciousness, this mass understanding, and translating it to driving Bush from office before January 20th, 2009? That's an awfully long time from now, and he can do a incredible amount of damage, including this mass bombing of Iran that he could that a lot of people are convinced he's going to carry out. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. We're sort of in this period of fatigue, and you have demonstrations and a couple hundred people come out or something like that. So it is tough, but I appreciate you posing that. Here's what MikeMalloy.com wrote. This is from, let me see, where is this? So the UK's newspaper. The Herald has the plans. Strategists are understood to present two options for pinpoint strikes against B-2 bombers flying directly from bases in Missouri, Guam, and Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. The main plan calls for a rolling five-day bombing campaign against 400 key targets in Iran, including 24 nuclear-related sites, 14 military airfields and radar installations, and Revolutionary Guard headquarters. At least 75 targets in underground complexes would be attacked with waves of bunker buster bombs. Iranian radar networks and air defense bases would be struck by submarine-launched Tomahawk cruise missiles, and then kept out of action by carrier aircraft flying from warships in the Indian Ocean and Persian Gulf. The alternative to an all-out campaign is a demonstration strike against one or two high-profile targets. Well, all hell will break loose if that occurs. On the other hand, I mean, Iran does not have nuclear weapons. They may be trying to develop them. On the other hand, one can understand why. Because the United States attacks countries that does not have weapons of mass destruction, like Iraq. The United States is 6,000 miles from its home. It is right on the border of Iran. Translate that into some other country being in Mexico, fighting a huge war in Mexico. Hostile power, a power hostile to you, fighting a war, trying to suppress rebels, insurgents in Mexico. On the other hand, North Korea, who does have weapons of mass destruction and threatens the United States, here's what is going on there. President Bush's top advisors have recommended a broad new approach to dealing with North Korea that would include beginning negotiations on a peace treaty, even while efforts to dismantle the country's nuclear program are still underway, according to senior officials. So there. All right, here's Audrey. Audrey's in Ann Arbor. Hi, Audrey.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for letting me come on.
Sure.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the immigration issues.
Please.
I'm really concerned about the demonstrations, not that they shouldn't be happening, but that I think that this will be used by Bush's fearmongers to set up a militaristic response. And he's already saying that they're going to put all of those guardsmen down on the borders, but they're so-called not going to be doing anything.
Yeah,
I think that's just a ploy. I think they're going to wait until the folks do something, some, you know, silly incident, and then they're going to be blasting away at people.
I sure hope not, because I think all of this, anything that turns out violent, whether it's in Iran, which I don't think, by the way, that's what this paper says. That could be one of the military options. I don't think Bush is, you could remind me how wrong I was, but I don't think Bush is going to attack Iran. I don't think that, but any kind of violence against this country is just going to play really bad for him. So
yeah, well, I hope you're right, but I can see things happening on our borders. Because you have to ask yourself the question, why would he send guardsmen down to the Mexican border?
That's the political ploy.
If they weren't going to be doing something down there.
No, they're just, as you said, wasn't it? They're just supposed to be observed.
Yeah, but why would he put them there to begin with if he wasn't going to help us set up a situation that would justify a militaristic approach to solving our problems in this country? And I do believe, one thing I do believe is that they are afraid of people in the streets protesting. And I think that this last protest of the workers who are not citizens of our country, I think that was a big worry to them. And I think they know they're going to see more of that kind of thing.
I think they will. All right, I got to end the show. Thanks for being our last caller. I'd appreciate it very much. Just wanted to get here is I always get these emails from this guy, Mark in Columbus. I rarely pay any attention to him. What are we number one? He says, we're number one in the standard of living. We are not number one in the standard of living, Mark. We are number one in productivity. We are not number one in productivity, Mark. We are number one in agriculture production. I don't know, but I doubt it. And we're number one in technology. I don't know about that one either. I doubt it. I doubt that as well. But, hey, send me some facts, please. All right, we're going to say goodnight on our live call-in part of the show, but stay tuned. Got a couple of very, very interesting interviews to follow, including one that will take up the subject of immigration. So thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We'll talk live next week.
This is WRIM.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thanks a lot for joining me. Well, the economy. How difficult is it for the average person to get an idea of what is really going on? We get whipped around by the latest news reports. Is it immigrants? Is it the balance of trade? And the average person finds it pretty difficult. I know I do. That's why I depend on people that look at the economy, that think about it, and then write about it. Joining me again on the Peter Werby Show is Dean Baker. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and he's got a new book out, and it's not very expensive. In fact, if you're online, it's going to be free, and I'll tell you how to do that. The new book is called The Conservative Nanny State: How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. Dean Baker joins us from Washington, D.C. Dean, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Explain the term nanny state. I don't hear that too much about the American economy. They often talk about that in Britain, but has that been, must be something we're starting to use here.
Well, it's used sometimes, mostly as a pejorative. Well, I shouldn't say mostly. I'd say pretty much always as a pejorative, and kind of saying we don't want the United States to be like, you know, Britain or Sweden or, you know, France, whatever country we pick as the bad boy. And the idea of the nanny state, as it's usually used, is the idea that the government is looking out for people, babying them, in effect, looking out for them in a negative way, not trusting them to make their own decisions, and not letting people be independent. And, you know, you're thinking of policies like child care for kids, health care throughout their lives, pension benefits, unemployment benefits, things that, you know, protect people's income through their lifetime. And these are policies that certainly conservatives here look on as being very negative.
Yeah, and it's also, there's sort of even a psychoanalytic aspect to it. Muscular Americans with our muscular economy doesn't need government intervention. In fact, the prevailing conservative myth is that just kind of mucks everything up, right? That better left to the invisible hand of the market. I believe that's their official ideology. Is that what you would see it as?
Exactly. That's how they've portrayed it. So on the one hand, you have people that, you know, want the government in there looking out for everyone because, you know, they're weak and, you know, feminine or whatever, and, you know, they aren't prepared to be there on the world on their own. And on the other hand, you have the conservatives who believe in the market, just, you know, give us, you know, get out of the way and let us get things done.
Yeah, and the other aspect of it is that it doesn't work, is that the market can best take care of everything from wages to pensions and what have you, and what we wind up with, liberal, what do they used to call it, tax and spend, that was the mantra the conservatives used against the liberals. It essentially just took tax dollars away from ordinary working people and frittered it away in programs that didn't work.
Exactly. So the idea was that, you know, you're taking, you know, taking people's money out of their pocket. They know how to spend it better than, you know, the government. You're taking away their incentive to work, and instead you're blowing it on, you know, wasteful programs, encouraging people to be slothful, you know, welfare cheats. You know the list. So that's the basic story.
It's extraordinary, the success of it, though, because we're going to have to spend, Dean Baker, at least a few minutes refuting that portrayal of the negative portrayal, the pejorative portrayal of social programs and government intervention in the life of the community. Isn't what conservatives make out. And then the opposite end, what's your book, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, illustrates a hypocrisy. Let's start with the first part, the negative portrayal of really the New Deal programs going back into the 1930s, up to and including Social Security, which we're being told has been mismanaged by the terrible federal government.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you find there is that there's actually a very mixed record. You could find examples of, you know, programs that have been managed badly, haven't done what they're supposed to do, but, you know, the programs that have survived, you know, and we want the good ones to survive, we want the bad ones not to, but the programs that we all look to, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, those do pretty much what they're supposed to do, and in fact, they do it very effectively, very efficiently, and Social Security is, you know, one that I could speak on because I've done a lot of work on that, and a lot of speaking and a lot of writing on it. It's an incredibly efficient program, and, you know, what was the purpose? Well, it was to provide workers with a core retirement income in their old age so that they weren't in poverty or dependent on their kids, and, you know, that's basically what it's done. And, you know, the administrative costs, Social Security are a fraction of, you know, the administrative cost, about 1/20 of the administrative cost of, you know, private sector pension funds. So, you know, you can look at a program like that and say, well, what did we want to do? It's done it very well. Medicare, the fact that, you know, people over 65, my mother, you know, a lot of people's parents or grandparents, you know, that they have their health care paid for. I mean, that's a really, really big thing. And again, compare the administrative cost of Medicare with private insurers, it's about 1/10 as much. So these are programs that do what they're supposed to do. They provide an element of security for, you know, large segments of the population that otherwise wouldn't have it, and they do it very efficiently. So, you know, you could point to those success stories, and, you know, the fact of the matter is the public hugely values those programs as well.
Well, the last time we spoke, in fact, and did an interview, it was about Social Security. And the two things that one hears, the first is, and we can address these one by one, is I hear people, if I was to take the money that went into Social Security and put it in annuities or put it in the stock market, rather than getting $1,400 a month, I'd have $17 million by the time I retired. So I'm essentially getting ripped off. I'm paying poor people's retirement fund because they weren't,
prudent
or whatever.
Yeah. Well, the key story with Social Security, I mean, the key sort of misleading, there are a couple of misleading elements. One is people are, you know, making fanciful assumptions about stock returns, and I've been around the block with everyone on that one. I think most people have backed away, at least the economists have backed away from some of the things that they had been claiming. But the other part of the story, that when people make these comparisons that, you know, they're ignoring in the picture, that at the moment we have, you know, 30-plus million people getting Social Security benefits. That money is being paid for out of current taxes. Now, maybe they don't like that, but unless someone's prepared to tell those people to get lost, and I don't know many people are prepared to do that, that money has to come from current taxes. Now, I've been on people, they do a little shell game, and they go, oh, well, we'll let you take your money and put it in the accounts, and you'll get this or that return. And then you go, oh, well, what about the people who are currently getting Social Security? They go, oh, well, we'll have a transition tax. You know, and, of course, your return on your transition tax is minus 100%. You're paying for those people's Social Security, and you're not seeing a penny of it. So, you know, you can play shell games, but that's just silly. There's no money dropped from air, and, you know, maybe we don't like the fact that, we set up Social Security, the first generation to get it, didn't really pay for it. You know, that was in the 30s under Roosevelt. They had paid very little money in, and they were starting to get, you know, they got their payments back, so they're getting way more than they put in. Maybe that was bad. I mean, you could argue about that, but the fact was that was done. So now we're in a situation where, you know, our choices are either we tell the people who are already retired to get lost, or we have to tax ourselves to pay the benefits. Those are the two choices.
The book is The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. It's available to download free as a PDF. You can go to conservativenannystate.org, conservativenannystate.org, the middle word, N-A-N-N-Y, conservativenannystate.org. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Dean Baker, he is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. Just let's spend one more minute or two on Social Security. We've all of a sudden, it's the failure, quote, of, or the catastrophe looming ahead, in quotes, for Social Security has suddenly came back, although not much was made of it, saying that it's going to go broke sooner than we thought. It's not going to go broke, is it, Dean Baker?
Well, no. I mean, without getting too much of the technicalities of the projections, first off, what they show is that the program could pay every penny of scheduled benefits through the year 2040 with no changes whatsoever. And I'll just point out that there's another set of projections from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that put that date at 2052, again, with no changes whatsoever. And then you go, okay, and then what happens after that? Those dates, 2041 and the one projections from the trustees, 53 and the projections from the Congressional Budget Office, we still have a lot of taxes coming in. You'd be able to pay between 70 and 80 cents on the dollar of benefits. So what that would mean is that if we never did anything, you know, 35 years out in one case and about 47 years out in the other, we would face a shortfall. Well, we faced a shortfall in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. We have a lot of time to deal with it. Would we want to raise taxes? Well, people get very upset. They won't want to raise taxes, but in fact, in the 80s, they raised taxes. And to my knowledge, not a single member of Congress lost their seat because they voted to raise taxes. You know, will they decide to do that in 2041 or 2052? I actually don't know, and I don't feel a real need to tell people what they should do, and they probably aren't going to listen to me 50 years from now. So, but the point is, these are very distant dates, and the fact that we might need to pay somewhat higher taxes, not because anyone mismanaged the program, but because we project that we'll be living longer, you know, 30 and 40 and 50 years from now, and that will cost more money. So it's, you know, it's not a problem with the program. It's, I wouldn't call it a problem. It's the fact that people are living longer. That does cost more money. We've dealt with that in prior decades. I don't really see why, you know, when we're projected projected to have incomes that are, you know, 60 to 70% higher than they are today, why we would view that as a catastrophe if, let's say, we did raise the tax by 1 or 2 or 3 percentage points.
So this is politically motivated?
Absolutely. I mean, if you just put the facts on the table of people, I mean, you know, as I say, the shortfall isn't that large. You could do things, for example, like raise the cap. So instead of having all the income over 90,000, you know, if I'm a wage earner and I'm earning 150,000, I'm only taxed on the first 90,000.
Or if you're making 27 million.
27 million, exactly. Yeah. You know, so you could go a very long way towards eliminating the shortfall in the program simply by raising the cap on the tax and have higher income people pay the same tax rate that, you know, a school teacher, a firefighter, an auto worker would pay.
You know, you've said that very clearly, but I just want to emphasize that one more time, is that there's the withholding tax that has a cap on it of about 90,000, and that most everyone you and I know, probably most everyone listening, pay in from every penny we earn. Once you get over that, you cease paying tax.
That's right. So Bill Gates, or I don't know if he's still on a wage there at Microsoft, but whatever, you know, someone earning 1 or 2 or 3 million, 20 million, they are paying no more tax than the person earning 90,000.
Yeah, so that would solve the Social Security, quote, catastrophe. Let's go into the thesis of your book, though. This has been a long time coming, my fault. The book is The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. And we all thought, since they advocate the anonymous forces of the market, that they didn't utilize the government at all. How do they do that?
Yeah, well, they do it in lots of different ways, and the one thing that I give them credit for is they're smart enough not to own up to it. So let me mention a few of the big ones. You know, they're in Detroit. Obviously, you have a lot of people in the auto industry who've lost their job, worried about losing their job. One of the big factors is import competition. Well, we've signed all these trade agreements. They like to call them free trade agreements, and, you know, the purpose of them, NAFTA, I mean, you know, the long list, the purpose has been to make it as easy as possible for foreign manufacturers to compete with workers in the U.S. So, you know, the auto parts industry, the auto manufacturers, you know, certainly in the textile industry, you go down the list, it's very easy now to set up an operation in Mexico and China and Malaysia, hire very low-cost labor there, and then sell your goods back to the United States. That was the purpose of those agreements. It's not an accident. That was the point of them. So our workers have to compete with people in those countries that get paid very low wages. I'm an economist. I can tell you how, in principle, that's supposed to be good, not for the auto workers, but for consumers, for the economy. Well, I could tell you the exact same story. Suppose our trade negotiators, instead of saying they want to make the auto workers in Detroit compete with, you know, auto workers in Mexico or China, they said, look, there's a lot of really bright people in Mexico and China and India and these other countries. They don't get paid a fraction of what we do in the United States. Why don't we have them trained to U.S. standards, have them work as doctors, as lawyers, as economists, as accountants in the United States? They'll work at a fraction of the pay because they'd be delighted to get that. That's way better than what they can get in their countries. And it will reduce the cost of health care for people in the United States, reduce the cost of legal services, reduce the cost of a college education. You would make the exact same argument for the huge economic gains, in fact, much, much larger than what you could talk about with NAFTA or CAFTA or the other trade agreements. And instead of putting downward pressure on the wages of people at the middle and the bottom, this would be putting downward pressure on the highest wage workers. So we didn't do that, and that's because the doctors and the lawyers and the economists and accountants are smart enough to have the government protect them. So it's very difficult, not impossible. I know Indian doctors, you know, there are foreign doctors and economists and accountants that come in the country, but it's very difficult for those people to work in the United States and compete with, you know, high-end professionals, including myself in that category. It's very difficult for them to compete, whereas the whole purpose of trade agreements negotiated over the last quarter century is to make it very easy to have low-cost workers in the developing world compete with our auto workers.
And, of course, some of them, as the debate has been going on recently, and today, in fact, about illegal immigrants who are coming here from their countries, Mexico, Central America particularly, because attracted by the higher wages, yet these trade agreements were supposed to be elevating the economies of places like Mexico and Salvador and Nicaragua and what have you. Why hasn't that worked? Why hasn't the economies of those of Mexico and Central American countries risen because of these trade agreements to the point where people could earn a living there and support their families?
That's a really good question, and it's really an outrage that more attention hasn't been paid to this. Mexico's had horrible growth since NAFTA. You know, its growth rate, per person growth rate, has been just a little over 1% a year. That's really, really bad for a developing country. You know, Mexico in the period, if you go to from 1960 to 1980, used to grow at 4% a year, four times as fast almost as it's done in the post-NAFTA era. What's happened is that NAFTA's had a lot of negative impacts on Mexico. It's been all been negative, but, you know, one of the big factors has been that low-cost U.S. grain has displaced a lot of their, you know, peasant farming. And these people don't have a lot of alternatives, so they come up to the United States looking for jobs. And by the way, let me mention here again, it's a very good case, you know, when I talk about the government rules, how they're structured to rig the deck. When Mexican workers come up here, you know, the vast majority are coming up here, as we know, are working off the books. Now, who is willing to come up to the United States and work off the books? We pretend that this is just a market story, that they take jobs that people in the United States won't take. Well, they work as dishwashers, they work in the fields, they work increasingly in construction. A lot of these jobs actually used to be fairly well paid. Construction, when I was growing up, if you're really lucky, if you're college in summer, work as in construction, because that was a good paying job. Not anymore in many cases, because you have people from, Mexico and other countries that are willing to work at very low wages. Now, you don't have doctors from Mexico, lawyers or economists coming and working off the table because, one, they're not going to take a risk of dying at the border, which, you know, a lot of people seem to think is very funny. I happen not to, you know, that we're subjecting these people to risking death. And two, once they come up here, they're not going to take the risk. They're not going to work off the books. I mean, these are people who would have a decent income, not great, but a decent income in, you know, Mexico or whatever country they come from. So our immigration policy is, again, another example where we, in effect, allow workers to come and work off the books or to work with phony documentation. The people who will agree to do that are people who are going to compete at the lower or middle end of the workforce. They're not going to be competing with doctors and lawyers. That just isn't going to happen. So yet again, it's a way in which, you know, our policy has stacked the deck against those at the middle and bottom to the benefit of those at the top.
The solutions that are suggested always seem sort of unrealistic on the hard edge, the hard right. Round them all up and send them all back. That'd be a pleasant scene, rounding up 10, 11, 12.
Yeah, I mean, just to talk about it seriously, I mean, I think any solution that doesn't say that the people are up here, we've had this, dance around the word amnesty, but look, they're up here. They were here with the knowledge and consent. It was a government policy. You know, they didn't break the law in any meaningful way because, I'm sorry, if George Bush does want to say he's too incompetent to be president, maybe he didn't know they were here. But, we knew they were here, and it was conscious government policy to allow these people to be here. So to adopt punitive measures, that's just absurd, So any serious discussion has to say, look, we have whatever number of people here. They're allowed to stay here, if you want to make them cross some T's and dot some I's or whatever. But, any serious policy in immigration has to say that the people are here stay here if they want. But the question is, okay, going forward, what do we do? And you're not going to keep immigrants out by tightening up at the border. I mean, that's just absurd. And, you're just going to make it more difficult, and people will still try to get here. You'll just have more people dying, and, that's not going to solve that. Any serious control of immigration has to deal with employers. It simply has to, make mm-hmm. a serious sanctions against employers that knowingly hire people who don't have legal documents.
Yeah, for one thing, I just heard figures today that 40% of the illegals are people that came here legally on visas and are just overstaying.
Absolutely. So you can do all you want at the border, and you aren't going to do anything about those people. So it's, that's where it has to begin. That's the border. You're not going to keep out people who want to work here at the border. You cause more of them to die, but, that's not... It's not the way to do it.
Well, Dean Baker, we've spoken precious little about your brand-new book, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. It's available as a free download, 191 pages, I believe. ConservativeNannyState.org, ConservativeNannyState.org. If you must have it in paperback, $6.91. And you can go to the Center for Economic and Policy Research site, I assume?
Yeah, CEPR.net.
Yeah, okay, CEPR.net. I'll have that as a link on my site. Peter Werby as well. You said that allowing illegal immigration was, quote, government policy. Tell us about that. Tell us how it figures into the thesis of your book as well.
Well, again, I mean, it's a basic story of supply and demand, that if we think of the labor market, we're putting some workers in competition, increasing the supply, and in other cases, we're restricting it. So, you know, I was mentioning trade a moment ago, so that our auto workers have to compete with auto workers in Mexico or China, wherever it might be. And immigration is another way in which, you know, the less skilled workers, you know, people are less educated, end up having to compete with workers from the developing world. So, you know, obviously people from Mexico, El Salvador, whatever countries, these are very often people in desperate straits, and they're willing to work for much lower wages than, you know, our native-born population. On the other hand, we don't allow doctors, lawyers, you know, economists, accountants. We're not going to let a free flow of those people from the developing world come to the United States and compete with, you know, our professionals. So it's a very one-sided story, and, you know, what it means is wages for those at the middle and the bottom get pushed down. At the top end, you know, if you're, you know, a successful lawyer, well, you could benefit by having cheaper restaurant meals because the people working in the restaurant might be, you know, people who are not here legally, not paid very much, get cheap nannies, you know, you go down the list of things. So it's a policy that's designed to redistribute wage income upwards. It benefits those at the top. It hurts those at the middle and the bottom.
How about more general policy, how the wealthy use the government to stay rich and get richer? We've heard the term, it's not a new one, like nanny state, but corporate welfare. That's what liberals would refute conservatives when they say, you know, the welfare mom, we'd say, hey, that pales before corporate welfare. There's an extraordinary amount of that, isn't there?
Well, there is. I mean, I actually try to shy away from that in the book for the simple reason I like to focus how they structure the market. So, you know, I give examples like immigration, like trade, Federal Reserve Board policy. You know, we're hearing now that the Federal Reserve Board is raising interest rates because they're worried that the economy might overheat. Well, people don't realize that. What does that mean when the Fed's raise interest rates? It all sounds very antiseptic, like, you know, they're adjusting levers and this and that. Well, what it means, the Federal Reserve Board is raising interest rates to throw people out of work.
Tell us about that. We're concerned about that in Detroit.
Well, yeah, no, and you should be. I mean, they won't use that expression, but, you know, I could sit down with any economist. If they're honest, they'll say that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, they think that that's the best thing for the economy. But the story, how does the Federal Reserve Board control inflation by raising interest rates? Well, raising interest rates slows home purchases, slows car purchases, and that means when people buy fewer homes, they buy fewer cars. Auto workers get laid off, construction workers get laid off, other people that are sort of employed in the industries, the parts industry, they lose their jobs. What that means is it means there's more downward pressure on wages for auto workers, construction workers, other people that are affected, typically not doctors, lawyers, or accountants. That's conscious policy. And again, maybe it's the right choice. Maybe, you know, when they raise interest rates, they're right. That's the best way we can control inflation. But that people have to understand that's not something that, you know, they're sitting there in their white coats and just, you know, all antiseptic. They're trying. It's a conscious decision. They want to put downward pressure on wages for large segments of the population because that's how they think is the best way to control inflation.
So what they're looking at in economics, macroeconomics, how's this going to affect the entire system, mainly return on investments for the you know, the overall system. We wind up with a situation that the guy or gal in Sterling Heights gets laid off, or a Mexican farmer gets the choice of either having to live in a slum in Mexico City or sneaking across the border. It really leaves out, doesn't it, the human factor?
Absolutely. And again, it would become a much more debatable point, let me put it that way, if people understood the proposition that, you know, everyone agrees we don't want, you know, we don't want hyperinflation, no issue. Okay, but we aren't talking about hyperinflation. We're talking about the inflation rate. Is it going to be 3%? Is it going to be 3.5%? Probably most of us would rather be 3, but we wouldn't care all that much for 3.5, you know. And if the issue is the trade-off there is that we might be throwing another 500,000 or million people out of work, maybe we'd say let inflation be 3.5%. Maybe we'd come to a different conclusion.
Hmm.
So well, it's not, you know, something that's all antiseptic and, you know, it's a clear call. And I'll just point out, they've been wrong on this in really big ways. They don't like to point that out. I'm saying this as an economist, so maybe I should be the we in there, too. It should be more we, except I was on the other side of them. But, you know, the point was, it's not like we can get a group of economists together and they could all sit there and go, oh, we know this, you know, like they get, you know, a group of physicists can tell us how fast a rocket has to go to get to the moon.
Well, Dean Baker, we're going to have to let it go at that, which is unfortunate, because what we really need to look at is solutions. And all of this is suggested both at the Center for Economic and Policy Research site, which is CEPR.net. And Dean Baker's brand new book, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, and I would say at our expense, you can download it for free at conservativenannystate.org, where it's available in paperback for $6.91. You can also go to my website, peterwerby.com, and I'll have a link to that. Dean Baker, as usual, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We'll be right back.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. As a host of a program, I'm sure you can imagine, listening audience, that I choose authors. And there's some subjects that I choose that I think you might not even be interested in. And I'm hoping when I introduce an author, you will be. Other times, there's ones that I know you'll be interested in. There are very few subjects, though, that I think are of utmost importance, yet almost tend to shy away from them. And you notice I stress tend. And one of those subjects is the United States' use of torture, of force, of brutality. Because it's been my experience over the years that audiences in lots of ways don't like this information. It's like mentioning that Aunt Rose is drooling at the table. We all know this, but in polite company, you don't mention this. Because ultimately, the family is good, the family is motivated by good purposes, and so we don't want to talk about those things. We don't want to talk about the history of suppression of Native people. We don't want to talk about what happens in American prisons. And when we hear about something like Abu Ghraib, it's very convenient and very satisfying to know that it's only a few bad apples. It's not policy. It doesn't have a history. Well, sorry to break this illusion, dear friends, but let's go into the subject with Christian Williams. He's a writer, and he has just issued the book from South End Press. It's called American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination. And Christian Williams joins us from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I hope that didn't sound like an apology. If it was really for myself and not for you, because I think this kind of material is extraordinarily important. And maybe you could begin to get into this, your book, American Methods, by talking about the cover. There's Martin Luther King Jr., very young man, probably in the late 1950s, being hustled away by Southern police. But then on the bottom, there's American soldiers, could be from Iraq, with an American soldier with his hand around the neck of a young Iraqi, perhaps. Tell us the connection and tell us a little about your central thesis.
I don't really get to take credit for the cover, of course. The designer handled that. But I was very pleased with their choice of images. Shortly after the picture of Martin Luther King was taken, he was thrown in jail and said that he was beaten up by the police that were arresting him. And the other image, which is...
So that must have been Birmingham. That must have been the Birmingham jail experience, I suspect.
I believe it was, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
The other image, which I believe is from Iraq, was the visual resonance between the two is very close. Like, they're really sort of mirror images of each other, except that one is a very prominent figure from American history and American police, and the other is unknown Iraqi young man, and the figures are American soldiers who are overseas. The argument of the book really is that we need to look at both kinds of cases to understand torture. Like, if we just look at what the American government does overseas in other places, we're not going to get the full picture. We're not even going to understand what's happening abroad unless we also look at what's happening here in the United States. Or if we just look at what happens in policing and in prisons in the United States and don't relate it to the position of the United States globally, then we're going to misunderstand what's happening domestically as well. That in fact the connections between what our government does overseas and the way it behaves at home are actually very, very close.
Well, couldn't the argument be made, I think it would be, that when you look at a picture of Martin Luther King Jr., an extraordinarily brave man to face down these brutal Southern police 50 years ago, half a century ago, that the kind of prevalence of that type of racist oppression, the kind of police brutality that that was present in almost every big city, maybe even in lots of little cities as well, is something that we've made great strides from. And as I said in the introduction, whereas there were horrible abuses at prisons like Abu Ghraib and others in Afghanistan and at Guantanamo, this is the bad apple theory. And we've gotten rid of the institutional basis of brutality in America. And if it's happening abroad, it's just some bad men and women.
Well, thanks, Tim. It's different than it once was. I mean, there aren't a lot of big city police chiefs who go around talking like Bull Connor used to. But that doesn't mean that racism has just gone away. And the there's necessarily an element of violence and brutality that accompanies the sort of racial stratification which still persists. And the tendency is very much, you're right, the tendency is very much to look at this in terms of, to look at abuses like what happened at Abu Ghraib in terms of individual people who are culpable. And in Abu Ghraib, it's the people who have paid the highest price for their role there have been the people of the lowest ranks. And in a way, that's because it's sort of a comforting notion that the system as a whole is basically good, but it's not perfect, and so a few sort of bad people do bad things within it. And in a way, it's the result of the media's tendency to want to, you know, tell stories about individual people, and that runs the risk of sort of making the Abu Ghraib story about Lindy England and her affair with Charles Grainger and not about U.S. intervention in Iraq. Part of my project in writing the book was really to emphasize the institutional aspect, to show how what happened in Abu Ghraib wasn't simply a matter of a handful of soldiers getting out of hand. It was also the result of policy decisions that were made months before in Washington, D.C. and at the Pentagon, and that those decisions themselves were part of a much broader context involving the United States trying to increase its position globally and assert itself and increase its power internationally. So none of that is to let off the hook the individuals who participate in abuses, of course. But in order to understand why they occur, and especially once we start to consider the scale on which they're occurring, we really need to look at the institutional forces that are at play.
Well, I certainly think so. And I've said before on different broadcasts that we can look throughout modern history, particularly the 20th century, and we realize that men will do to other people, sometimes even women, will do to other people whatever they have social permission to do, whatever they think is sanctioned. And if they are required to be nice to everybody, usually they are. If they're given free rein, if they're actually encouraged to be brutal, you can always find a percentage of human beings within the general population that are willing to carry out the worst abuses imaginable. So speak to that a little, because still the argument that the permission for torture at Guantanamo, at Abu Ghraib, at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan goes up the chain of command pretty high, maybe even into the White House, is one thing. Then again, we still have bad guys, but they're just a little higher up the chain of command. You speak, though, that this is within the system itself and has long antecedents.
Yes, it's pretty, it's relatively easy, actually, to trace the policy decisions from, for example, President Bush's decision to that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply to the war in Afghanistan, and then the decision that really no law applied at Guantanamo Bay, that the prisoners were not not protected according to the demands of law in the United States, and they weren't covered by the Geneva Conventions or other international law. And it's pretty easy to follow the practices that got going step by step from the one place to the other and eventually to Abu Ghraib. Part of the argument that I make in the book is that decision, the decision of the Bush administration to exempt itself from the Geneva Conventions, it isn't really that unique. The first President Bush in the U.S. invasion of Panama also determined that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply as a matter of law, but would apply as a matter of policy, which is really sort of trying to have it both ways. It's like, well, the law doesn't hold, but we're going to pretend for the moment that it does. That's just one particular parallel to the current situation. There's really a whole line of there's a well-established pattern of the United States simply ignoring or assertively making an exception for itself in the area of international law. And perhaps this is best shown by the administration's attitude to the International Criminal Court, which would basically be a standing war crimes tribunal. The U.S. government has gone through extraordinary lengths, first of all, trying not to get the ICC formed at all, and then pushing other countries to agree to never deliver any U.S. citizen to the ICC. So if an American citizen is, that's now a condition of all of our foreign aid. So in order to get foreign aid, you have to promise that if there's an American citizen in your country who's been accused of war crimes, that you won't turn him over to this international tribunal. And then Congress took the further step of passing a law authorizing the use of military force to rescue any U.S. soldier who ends up being charged at the ICC. So it's really, there we see a long-term project of the United States trying to make international law unenforceable in its own case.
Unilaterally, of course. Christian Williams is my guest. His book is American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination. It's available from South End Press. It's a good site to look at for important reading. It's southendpress.org. Well, let me, I always try to anticipate all objections to my guest's statements. And so maybe someone's out there, Christian, saying, why do you have this tender concern for people in other countries, and some of who may be terrorists and people like in Panama? I mean, what motivates you to even start off in this direction? And again, it doesn't portray, quote, us, although I never think of it as us. I'm not doing this, and no one listening is. What's the motivation in here, and why, to use the most sort of cynical phrase, why the tender concern for people that are subjected to what you're describing as brutality?
There are several reasons. One is that, it may not be you and I who put on the uniforms and go apply the electrodes, but to the degree that the United States is a democracy, we are responsible for what our government does. And if it's doing things that are unacceptable by our moral standards, then, you know, first of all, we should know that, and secondly, we should do something to make it stop. Also, there's the fact that, you know, remember what I said earlier about the connection between the what our government does overseas and conditions at home. And the things that the U.S. government practices that it establishes originally for, you know, our official enemies end up being replicated in the domestic sphere. So for example, in Guantanamo Bay, there's a special unit called the Internal Reaction Force, which is basically a riot squad that removes inmates from their cells and puts down disturbances and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
This was modeled on similar units in American prisons, which were in turn modeled on SWAT teams in U.S. police forces, which the first SWAT team was developed by Daryl Gates in the LAPD, and he specifically modeled it on special forces units in the U.S. military. So there we have sort of a full cycle of, you know, this type of organization and this set of practices, beginning in the military, moving to the police domestically, moving to the prisons, and then moving back to the military in military prisons. So it's sort of a mistake to think that we can disregard the rights and the dignity of people in other parts of the world and still expect them to be respected among American citizens at home.
You know, I know that when the first Abu Ghraib photographs came out quite a while ago, that I think it was George Bush who said, this is completely un-American. And so I Googled something like U.S. prison brutality. That was amazing, absolutely amazing, how many tens of thousands of citations there were and sites you could go to. And in fact, there is a connection between American prisons, who's running the whole, who's administering the American prisons in Iraq, and people like Sergeant Grainer, who was himself a prison guard, right, in the United States.
Yeah, Grainer wasn't the only one. Chip Frederick was also a prison guard, who was also implicated in the Abu Ghraib scandal, was also a prison guard in the United States. Some of the training that the MPs got, who later served as Abu Ghraib, they got trained in Afghanistan by men who work normally as prison guards in the United States. Lane McCotter used to be the head of the Utah State Department of Corrections and resigned from there after a scandal involving an inmate dying in their restraint chair. And he got given the job of rebuilding the physical structure of the prison at Abu Ghraib. So the connections are really very close. And, you know, for example, a National Guard soldier who works as a prison guard usually and who gets deployed to Iraq and ends up being a prison guard in Iraq, he's going to, unlike Frederick or Grainer, who are going to, you know, spend the next several years in prison, most of them are going to come back and serve as prison guards again in the United States. So, again, we should be very, very worried about what they are doing when they're overseas and the tendency to bring back some of the abusive practices.
Well, again, anticipating objections to what you're saying, is that everywhere from having to guard the thousands of people that have been arrested and that were sent to Abu Ghraib, almost virtually 90% of them innocent of any crime, here in the United States, where you have these huge concentrations of prisoners, and you have this massive industrial this prison industrial complex that needs thousands and thousands of prisoners to feed it, and in fact winds up with it, and who in situations that are very violent, someone might say, well, gee, Christian Williams, you're being naive. I mean, we're talking about some pretty mean, brutal, violent people. How would you suggest handling people that that are dangerous and violent?
Let's see. There are a couple different issues there. The first assumes that, well, the first is whether we're justified in doing, you know, really terrible things to people who may be dangerous and violent.
That's a moral question to me. That's extraordinarily important. But go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I think that the I spend about a whole chapter of the book addressing sort of the ethical arguments in favor and against torture, and I think that ultimately we can't sort of justify ab brutality in terms of the brutality of people who it may be used against. The second sort of aspect of that is that the we tend to assume that prisons are there for bad people, and therefore people who are in prisons are bad people. And the and in fact, the expansion of the prison over the last 20 or 25 years, and the growth of the inmate population and all that really doesn't reflect any sort of increase in crime. And so we need to look for other reasons that the prison is operating the way that it does. And I don't go into this in great detail in the book, but my argument overall is that things like prisons and police actually don't do very much, don't have very much to do with fighting crime or punishing bad guys or anything like that. And they have a great deal to do with the distribution of power within the United States and keeping people who are at the bottom of the social hierarchy at the bottom. And so, therefore, it follows from that there's this intense racial disparity among who goes to prison and who doesn't, and who comes to the attention of the police in the first place and who doesn't, and who suffers violence at the hands of these institutions and who doesn't. The harder question of, well, be that as it may, there is still crime, there is still terrorism, like, what do we do about it? Ultimately, I think we need to look for the social and the sociological roots of that kind of behavior and see what we can do that will change it, before the problems arise. In the medium term, I don't have a specific prescription of, like, well, instead of the criminal justice system as it is, we'll do this other thing. But it's pretty clear that the criminal justice system isn't working for what we want it to work for. It isn't actually reducing crime. It isn't actually, keeping us safe. And I don't talk about this very much in American Methods, but in my first book, Our Enemies in Blue, at the end, I spend the last chapter talking about places where the police authorities have been sort of displaced by by social unrest, and what social movements and the communities in the affected areas have done instead to maintain the public safety and enforce the law. And I look at a couple different cases in quite a lot of detail, one being...
Well, we're going to actually have to encourage people to look at your books because we're completely out of time. Just real quickly, I'd say, too, in terms of what to do at Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib never should have been established under American control, and that would have necessitated never having invaded and never occupied that country. All we had to do was look at Vietnam, look at the Philippines in 1900, and know that it was almost guaranteed we'd have a situation like that. Christian Williams has been my guest. His book is American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, and you can go to southendpress.org. There'll also be a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Christian Williams, thanks for having joined me.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
This is WRIF.com.
Thank you. nothing I can't.